from the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the March 2015 edition of the Bletchley Park podcast. This month we hear from screenwriter Graham Moore, whose adaptation of Andrew Hodge's book made him and the film The Imitation Game members of Hollywood's most exclusive set, Oscar winners. We'll hear what the Year Sixes from Greenlee's Junior School in Milton Keynes made of their free school trip to Bletchley Park when they became the first school to take advantage of a pilot bursary scheme. And we'll hear from a bomb wren, one of the women who joined the Navy, only to find out they'd be on dry land and operating state-of-the-art machinery that helped speed up the code-breaking process. Joan Martin was singled out during basic training along with her lifelong friend Joyce, and they ended up working as a pair at the outstation in Eastcote. But first, we take you on a very special tour of Bletchley Park with more than 20 members of Alan Turing's family. They came to walk in their famous relative's footsteps, seeing the places where his work helped shorten the war. More than 20 members of Alan Turing's family gathered at Bletchley Park to pay tribute to his contributions to the war-winning intelligence that emerged from this unassuming country estate. Arguably the most well-known of the Codebreakers, Turing's tragic death contributed to his fame as well as his breathtaking achievements. So it was a poignant visit for members of his family, some of whom had never been before and most who'd never met the man. Dermot Turing, a trustee of Bletchley Park and Alan Turing's nephew, took the opportunity to talk about exciting plans to tell the story of his uncle's co-invention in the newly restored Hut 11A.
Good morning, welcome to Bletchley Park. It's good to have a fantastic team cheering turnout. There's a few things happening today which I need to explain. The fact that team cheering is here is a matter of some media interest, and as Bletchley Park are kindly hosting us today, we have agreed that they can invite the media to come and sort of, you know, observe us doing our thing. Now, that will be in a limited area and for a limited time, because I know not everybody wants to be sort of having a TV camera sort of shoved in their face. And so there's a place called Hut 11A. Hut 11A is actually very exciting. When we get to Hut 11A, I want to explain to you and also to the media what the plans are for Hut 11A. Hut 11A is not currently open, and so that is where the TV cameras will be and the radio people will be. So if you don't want to be exposed to TV or radio, don't go near Hut 11A between 11:30 and lunchtime.
Right, let's have a quick look and see if I can see everybody. We like a challenge, don't we? Right, if everybody can see the front of that, you'll be in it. If you can't, then you won't. All right, so that's quite simple. So we're going to do a 3, 2, 1. Technical challenge.
Left the
lens. Two more, and then we're done.
That's great. The pond would like to get a picture of us near the pond.
Ladies and gentlemen, the bomb machine is the solution. The Enigma machine was the problem. What you see here is a real German Enigma machine. This particular model is the type used by the Army and the Air Force. There were many variants of the Enigma machine in World War II. Almost every branch of the state, not just the forces, had a variety of Enigma machine that they used to encipher their messages.
This building isn't normally open to the public. This is actually a historic building. It's the first building where they decided to move from putting the Codebreakers in these short-term wooden huts and put them in a more permanent accommodation. So this is rather more solid than the wooden huts. And this is the building in which they actually had the bombs during the course of the Second World War. Didn't have very many bombs at Bletchley Park. Actually, when code-breaking became a sort of more industrial enterprise, they concluded that the Bletchley Park site wasn't big enough to handle the bombs, so they were actually mostly elsewhere. But in this building, we had several bombs, and you can see from the size there's enough space to get quite a few in here. And it's our ambition here at Bletchley Park to try and restore this building. You can see that the exterior has actually been restored and put back to how it was in the 1940s. But the next step is to fill it with some content, an exhibition for visitors. And what we're hoping to do here is to actually tell the story of the bomb, how you use the bomb to do code-breaking on Enigma, essentially the stuff that we're doing currently in Block B, where you've just come from. But we've got loads of space here, so it'll be a really good opportunity to do all that. And I think the visitors find that the live bomb demos are sort of like a star piece of the sort of visit to Bletchley Park. And to be able to have in this building something that explains how the Enigma works and how the bomb helps you find the daily settings, and to explain a bit more about the bomb story, will be a really exciting opportunity for us. One thing that people don't often recognise is that, unlike many of the national museums in the UK, the Bletchley Park Trust doesn't have any direct government grant, so we have to be self-sustaining from ticket prices and sort of sales in the gift shop and the cafeteria and so forth to try and keep ourselves financially afloat. That's fine for sort of day-to-day operations, but it doesn't provide enough funding for something like setting up an exhibition in an empty, cold building like this. So we will be launching a campaign very shortly to try and funds the development of the exhibition here, and hopefully next time you come, then there'll be this will actually fill it with sort of really rather exciting exhibits, and help people understand a bit more about Alan Turing's clever ideas that actually enabled the setting on the Enigma to be found on a daily basis. So, happy to answer any questions about that. Pretty cold in here, so if you want to go outside be back in sunshine, that's I'm going to lead a march out that way, and then obviously I'm very happy to talk to any of you.
My name's Thomas Barnes, and Alan Turing's my great-granduncle. Yeah, so it's the first time the whole family's come here in mass.
I know, and is it strange? Because basically, the excitement with all these press guys with their cameras and videos and everything, it's because of a member of your family, is it weird?
Yeah, it does feel quite strange, but no, it's just amazing to be related to such an incredible person, to be honest.
And you've been dining out on it?
Slightly. No, it's amazing. I'm actually studying computing myself, so in a way Alan just gave me that confidence to go and study computing. It's absolutely fantastic.
Carrying on the family tradition.
Yeah, exactly. Well, apparently I'm the first person to actually do computing after Alan, the family. So yeah, that's quite a big thing. Yeah. Definitely helped for me to go into computing. I mean, it made me more interested in computing. I mean, from a young age, I was always interested in IT. Whenever I had an IT class at primary school, I got so excited by it. And then my parents were telling me about Alan, how I'm related to him. I was doing so much research on him. I was like, oh my God, I'm actually related to someone like this. So then it just made me want to do even more. And yeah, here I am doing a degree in computing.
What are you hoping to do after your degree?
Well, I'm applying for a lot of jobs at the moment. I'm applying at MI5, so hopefully maybe going to there.
That'd so you amazing. Really want to keep it in the family business?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It'd be fantastic too.
And maybe you can ask the question. Lovely, that'd be lovely. That's all we need. Yeah, but if you're standing, I don't know how you're related to it. If you're standing, you can ask them the question.
My name is Rachel Barnes, and I am a great niece of Alan Turing.
Is it a weird day today?
It is a very, very emotional day, and I'm finding it hard to take it all in, to be honest with you. I mean, what an incredible day to be here with the whole of the Turing family. to celebrate Alan Turing's achievements and also to start this fundraising.
And a long day for you, because after here you've got somewhere else to go, haven't you?
Yes, I have got a very, very exciting day today. After this interview I will be getting on a train up to London and I'm going to the BAFTAs this evening.
Again, because of Alan?
Because of Alan, so thank you to my great uncle.
Has it been a strange year? Or 6 months since the film came out, I guess, really?
Yes, it has been extremely strange and brilliant, just totally, totally brilliant. I mean, until the release of The Imitation Game, hardly anybody had heard of Alan. And now he is known by almost everybody and is practically a household name. So, yes, it's been fantastic for Alan Turing's legacy and very moving for the whole of the family.
You just want to get into the sun, don't you?
Well, yeah, it was getting a bit chilly.
Oh, gosh, I'm afraid. Lovely to see
you.
Thank you. Bye. Oh, it's a beautiful sunshine. It's warm in the sunshine. Isn't it lovely?
Yeah, that's why I was saying, oh, you should go around the corner.
Oh, gosh, it's different.
Very difficult to have an interview when you're staring straight into the sun, though.
Yeah.
My name is Neville Hunt, and I am the great-nephew of Alan Turing, the son of Shuna Hunt, who's one of the three nieces of Alan Turing.
Today's been a strange day.
It's been an amazing day today. It's, you know, mixed emotions today in terms of, you know, not my first visit to Bletchley Park. I always enjoy coming back here. It's probably fifth or sixth time now I've been to the park, but the first time with my family. I'm sad that my mum couldn't be here today, but she's preparing herself for the BAFTAs, which we're all very excited about. But no, to be with all my cousins and my two remaining aunts is fantastic. It's been a really great day. And yeah, I'm sort of wishing Bletchley Park all the best with raising some money to get Hut 11 finished. That was a first experience to see that hut, and each time I come, Bletchley seems to have made strides in improving the place, spending money and renovating various huts, and it continues to get better, and I want to come back to see what the next hut is that's completed on the next project. So.
And so you're off to the BAFTAs as well tonight then?
We are. Rachel and myself are going to represent the family along with my mother, Shuna. We were invited by the Studio Canal, and very much looking forward to mingling with the stars. It's a truly one-off experience, once-in-a-lifetime experience.
And, without doubt.
It's very, very exciting indeed.
I think what's been nice about today is especially a lot younger generations of the family being here for the first time and speaking to them, and they're really proud of their link to Alan, aren't they?
It is, and it's, you know, when friends of mine have been to Bletchley Park and I sort of explain the family connection, you know, it's obviously with a sense of immense pride that my great uncle was one of the key people that worked here. But, you know, we mustn't forget the other guys that worked here as well. And one of the most, well, perhaps the most emotional moments I had at Bletchley was during the centennial events, where I got the pleasure to meet Asa Briggs, who obviously worked alongside Alan. And, that was a very emotional day and very nice. You know, it was an honour to meet him and, you know, as one of the co-breakers there.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Have a lovely night.
Okay, this is the stable yard, which looks pretty much the way it would have done during the war. There was some stabling behind me, which was demolished very early on to allow access to the rest of the site. So when the war station was declared open, mid-August 1939, a very small code-breaking team arrived, led by a veteran World War I code-breaker by the name of Billy Knox. And Knox's team moved into cottage number 3. This cottage here has always just been known as the cottage. Had about 10 people, about 8 young women. He had one or two chaps working with him as well. When Britain declared war on September 3rd, the following day, Knox's team was joined by two mathematicians from the University of Cambridge. One, a chap you know very well, Alan Turing, the second, less well known, but equally important to Bletchley Park, Gordon Welshman. Both arrived on the 4th. Now, beginning of the war, Knox was in his dotage. He was 55 years old. Welshman and Turing were middle-aged at 33 and 27, respectively. Point being, the vast majority of people here throughout the war, average ages 18 to 21 years of age. Well before they arrived at Bletchley Park, Knox's team knew that the Germans had adopted and modified this encryption device, and they were completely stumped by it. and Knox had a great success in World War One.
The demo of the bomb, and they'll talk you through the Enigma machine, they'll talk you through the operation of the bomb, they'll do a demo of that. And for any of you who are of an engineering mentality, they will talk you through the rebuild project and how it is that they came to be able to piece together a rebuilt bomb without actually having one to copy and a great deal to go on. So that will be quite interesting. That's right now, down in Block B, which is where I will go next. But we haven't had a great deal of time to explore this part of the site.
So Dermot, here we are, just outside Block B, where the rebuild of the bomb, your ancestors' electromechanical device lives.
Yes.
It's been a really unusual day today, hasn't it?
It's been quite extraordinary, yes. Just had very large number of members of the family, probably the largest gathering of the clan that we've ever managed to achieve. We've all been here at Bletchley Park having a great day. We've just all been seeing a demo of the rebuilt bomb, so lots of younger members of the family now thoroughly, I think, bewildered about what it was that was going on, but I think they're all quite intrigued. So yeah, it's been good fun.
For me, that was the thing. There was three generations of Turin.
Yes,
yeah, wasn't there?
Yes, there were. Yes, there's three generations and lots of the younger generation, which is very nice to see, and including a couple of people who actually remember from their childhood Alan Turing himself. So that's been rather good too.
What really got me was the younger generation actually saying how proud they are to be part of this family.
I know,
and it's lovely, isn't it?
It's great. It's great. And yes, and I think there's lots. They're going off now to see other parts of the site and see Alan Turing's office in Hut 8 and things like that. So there's plenty for them to do. It's all very interesting. Yeah.
And lots of press here to help with the fundraising. Yes. For Hut 11A.
Yes, certainly lots of press and lots of family members stepping up to do little interviews and things with the press, which was rather nice. So hopefully the message about Hut 11A and needing to get some money to put the bomb exhibition up and running there, that hopefully has got across today as well.
So that room will be, I mean, it's lovely. It'll be a lovely room when it's done.
It will.
It's much bigger.
Yes, it's a nice big space to play with. On a cold day like today, it feels a bit bit unloved in there. But once we've put a nice exhibition in there and, you know, livened it up, then it'll be great.
It gives more room to be able to tell the story, doesn't
well,
it?
Well, and I think it means that we can tell the story in a bit more of a sort of slick and visitor-friendly kind of way. Yeah. Than we can at the minute. We haven't really got the resources for that where we are right now. I'm very heavily dependent on the bomb demonstrators, who do a cracking job, by the way, but you know, I think it will be helpful for them to have it less crowded and to have some aspects of the story presented to visitors in a sort of more varied kind of way. I think that will be good.
Winton Global Investment Management is funding free school trips to Bletchley Park. The company has funded a pilot bursary scheme. The bursaries are available to schools which might be in the need of financial support. They cover the cost of coach hire and 40 children attending two workshops. The first school to take this opportunity was Greenlees Junior School in Milton Keynes, who brought a group of Year 6 students to learn about code breaking.
Here today.
Well done. Right, so in your pack, other than the first two pages, all the rest are different codes. You could, all, they're all Playfair, they're all different sets you could try.
Anybody want to tell me what you think of what you've seen today?
I think it's really fascinating to see that and learn what's happening in the World War, what our children have done, and what you've done with this place.
And what did you think about the Enigma machine?
It's cool.
What's your name?
Cynthia.
And how old are you?
11.
Thank you very much, Cynthia. What about you? What did you think?
That it's actually quite interesting to see the real Enigma machine that was used in the World War II.
And have you ever been here before?
Yep.
And what would you tell people about it now? What do you think you would say when you go home to your mum and dad? And they say, what was it like?
I would tell them that it was quite interesting and you actually got to see what it was like in the war, and there was like a mansion owned by some people and lots of interesting things.
What's your name?
Grace.
How old are you?
10.
Thank you very much.
So you're going to fill it in yourself this time.
How?
Well, remember what I said. Cross out the letters we use, so H, O, L, and so on. The rest of the letters fill in the grid. But remember, J shares with I. So you, yeah. H-O-L-I. So you put I and J in there. Yeah? And then you can put them, the message into these groups and then read them exactly as you've done there.
And then we cross both I and J out.
Yes, that's right.
Hello there. Can I ask what you think of what you've seen today?
I thought it was really fun and most of the stuff I didn't know about when I first came here.
What surprised you?
How the Enigma machine works and why it worked and like all the stuff that we learned, like the Enigma machine. Which is really,
really
fun.
Complicated, isn't
yeah.
it? Yeah. But quite small for something so complicated
yeah.
back then. So did you know that this was here? Did you know how important this was right on your doorstep?
Yeah, I knew how important it was because it helped and win World War II.
And do you think now you'll tell other people they should come and see it? Come again yourself?
I'll tell people to come here because I think they'll think it's interesting.
Okay, well, thank you. What's your name?
Kai.
And how old are you, Kai?
10.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
So what you need to be a good agent, you have to be able to blend in enemy countries when there's no one there to help you. You have to be able to survive on your own when there's no one friendly. You have to be able to observe and find out because that's why you're there. You have to be able to get the information back to your own side. One way to do it is to hide a name in the sentence. So what boy's name can you see there?
John.
Yeah. Will.
Right. Okay. What girl's name can you see here?
Susan.
Who said Susan? Well done. You see it? Okay. Look at this one. Name of the fruit. Who's the orange? Well done. Yes, you see it.
Can I ask what you thought of the trip today?
I thought it's been absolutely fantastic. I've been really impressed. I came in the summer and did some code work with Derek and my own children. So coming back now and seeing how much it's changed is incredible.
And what do you think will stand out for the children?
I think the most important thing is they need to understand how important this place was. All of these things, when they're on your own doorstep, you don't realise just how incredible they are until you come round something. It's like living history.
And what's your name?
It's Mr. Dunkley, Paul.
Paul Dunkley.
Yes, no worries.
I won't ask how old you are.
Ah, very.
Thank you.
Children and families are in for a cracking Easter at Bletchley Park. On Easter Monday, the 6th of April, Bletchley Park, in partnership with Milton Keynes Suzuki, holds its hugely popular Easter Extravaganza. The day includes a chance to make your own Enigma, soft play, tours specifically designed for children and families, and an Easter trail around this uniquely historic site. Family Fun Wednesdays also make a welcome return this year on the 1st and 8th of April. The Imitation Game screenwriter Graham Moore has joined Hollywood's most exclusive club by winning the Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay. The film about Alan Turing is drawing people in droves to find out more about the Bletchley Park story. Trustee and Alan Turing's nephew, Dermot Turing, was delighted to hear the film had been honoured. We were lucky enough to interview Graham twice, first when they were filming scenes at Bletchley Park and then later at the premiere in London. His passion to bring Alan's story to the world was obvious in both interviews, and all of us at Bletchley Park wish him congratulations and thanks.
I think it's absolutely terrific news. It's a great movie, great acting, and the portrayal of Alan Turing by Benedict Cumberbatch is really splendid.
And of course, your own son in it. It was nice to have a real Turing in the Turing biopic.
Yes, it was. It's a shame that he didn't get an award himself, but he's only there in the bar scene and slightly out of focus. But he enjoyed being part of the setup, and I think he'll be pleased too. And also, it was nice to get Bletchley Park in the movie as well, because although obviously the film is about what happened at Bletchley Park, it wasn't possible to film a very large amount of it here, but there was just a little bit in the bar scene, which is the bit that my son James is in, and that was done here. So that's all very nice too.
And it's a great advert for us, and it brings people here to find out the story of all the code breakers, doesn't it?
Absolutely, that's the real thing. I mean, obviously the movie's a movie, it's not supposed to be a documentary, but if people want to find out, you know, what really happened and see where it happened, then that's great because they've got that opportunity. And particularly now the new visitor centre's opened here since the Duchess of Cambridge opened it in July. There's lots to see and do at Bletchley Park. So, you know, it's a great advert.
Are you paying attention?
Based on the incredible true story.
Who are you?
Alan Turing.
It's an instant classic.
Welcome to Enigma. It's unbreakable.
A superb thriller, 5 stars.
What if only a machine can defeat another machine?
Enigma will not save you.
You've got more secrets than the best of them.
The Imitation Game.
Let's start with you, Graham. How did you get involved?
I have wanted to write about Alan Turing since I was a teenager. It's always been a subject that's fascinated me. It may be sort of hard to imagine now because I'm so hip and cool. But as a teenager, I was fascinated by computer science. I went to computer sleepaway camp every summer when I was a kid. I was really into programming. And so among computer science people, as you don't need me to tell you, Turing is this object of intense study and fascination. So he was always a figure that I was aware of and who had this fascinating life story that I always wanted to write about and always wanted to tell.
We were just saying with Dermot this morning that it's almost Shakespearean, but you couldn't make it up,
yeah.
His story. The triumph and the tragedy together.
I think that if I had pitched you the Turing story as sort of a fictional thing, you'd be like, no, there's too much there. There's too much story. You'd never believe that all that really happened to one person.
When I asked Dermot Turing this morning what he thought of the casting of Benedict Cumberbatch, he said, couldn't be better. You must be thrilled to have got him for this part.
He really does, as Teddy said, bring just a level of sort of depth and immersion and realism to the character that the first time I saw him do it in rehearsals, I sort of gasped. It was better than I could possibly have imagined it. I feel very lucky to have an actor of that caliber, an actor of the caliber of everyone, saying my words. You know, I come off very well on their lips.
What's it like seeing it actually come to life? When you've sat alone in a room and written it, and then there's a room full of people.
It's remarkable. I mean, it's sort of, it's funny. I think we were talking about this the other day. You know, we spent so much time talking about the movie. I mean, we've sort of talked about every scene, every line, every moment so many times. And then you finally see it, and there's this sort of amazing moment when we get there and the cast is there and we watch the sort of first run through in the morning and it'll work. And you have this moment of like, oh, wow, this is actually working. This thing we talked about doing for so long and this thing we talked about being good for so long, you see it actually in front of the camera and it's like, wait, this actually is really good. Oh, fantastic. It's
there must be a point at which you have to kind of give it away and allow it to leave your control. It must be quite difficult.
He's trying.
Yeah.
You're laughing quietly.
I'm trying. Yeah, I mean, it's not my film. It's Morton's film. It's Teddy's film. I mean, it's sort of all of ours, right, in a sense.
Yeah.
It's the challenge we have as the custodians, if you like, of the Bletchley Park story, is to tell it in a very human way. And I can only think that this will really help advance that cause. What's it like, Graham, taking on a true story, a real character that actually lived? Because they don't only live inside your head. They have to live inside your head and have a foot in reality. But there has to be some artistic license as well.
Yeah, I think it's tricky. It's something we've obviously talked about a lot and something I've spent a lot of my adult life thinking about. I've sort of written a number of historical pieces. My first book was historical. My second book is historical. I've written a couple of historical scripts. And there's a huge opportunity there in telling true stories. And there's a huge, I think, obligation, an ethical one, a moral one, to sort of to remain true to sort of the fundamental story about what happened, while at the same time finding ways to make it dramatic.
Make people relate to it.
And I think it's funny, you know, many years later, you look back at the war and knowing how it turned out, you have that in your head when you look back on it. But if you think about what it would have been for these people to actually be here, to actually be at Bletchley, to sort of see the challenges they were facing, it must have felt like you were living through the end of the world. And these were the people who really were sort of right at the edge of that, at the precipice of it. And it's amazing to think that they all came together and very quietly did this thing that, you know, changed the course of the world without telling a soul.
Graham, how important was it to film at Bletchley Park?
Oh, it was crucial, and we always knew that, you know, this is a true story, and in paying tribute to Alan Turing and in paying tribute to all of the men and women at Bletchley Park, accuracy was sort of foremost in our minds, and the responsibility of telling the story and doing justice to all these people was foremost on our minds. So shooting at Bletchley Park was very important to that. From our first visits, you know, years before we started shooting, and even for me as a writer, just to walk around, walk down those paths and be in those buildings and to sort of feel that, we wanted the movie to have that sense too.
What sense of atmosphere did you get from visiting and walking around, perhaps unnoticed even in the early days of your research? What sense of what it was like during World War II did you get?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, when you walk around Bletchley Park, you realize, you know, as filmmakers, we realize the responsibility of the task at hand at telling the story and doing justice to it. And then just as a person, you realize what these people were able to accomplish with such sort of meager support and meager resources at their hands. You know, Bletchley wasn't a glamorous work environment. I mean, these people were able to, with very little resources, accomplish wonders, and was tremendous and set the bar very high for us as filmmakers.
How did you get into the subject in the first place? What was it that drew you to write about Alan Turing?
Oh, you know, I had been obsessed with the story of Alan Turing since I was a teenager. I was this huge computer nerd as a kid. I went to computer programming camp. I went to space camp. I'd always wanted to write about him, to tell his story on screen. And over the years, I kept sort of hoping someone would make like a proper Alan Turing film, like a sort of a proper biopic. And as, you know, just as a fan of films, as someone who wanted to see that story. And I feel so lucky that I, you know, years later got to be one of the people to get to do it.
And this is your first film, isn't it?
It is. It's my first film. It was my first time on a film set. I'd never done any of this before.
You jumped right in at the top then, didn't you? This is a big one.
It feels that way now. It would be very funny on set. Morton would tease me and he would joke about all the words I didn't know and all the acronyms and all the sort of film terms that he'd quiz me sometimes in the morning. He'd be like, Graham, do you know what it means? The blah, blah, blah. And I'd be like, no. And he'd be like, it means whatever filmmaking thing. And it was, you know, a tremendous responsibility to tell this story on screen, especially as my first film. It was, you know, it was a lot of sleepless nights and a lot of making sure that we really had a handle on it to do it properly.
What do you hope people will come away thinking or knowing about Alan Turing?
I think that, you know, we like to think of our film as a tribute to people who are different, as a tribute to people who, for whatever reason, do not fit into the societal mainstream. I think that was Turing's story for so many reasons. He was one of the most brilliant mathematicians of the 20th century. He was a war hero. He was a gay man at a time when that was not something that was speakable in polite society. And he was someone who, despite his differences, managed to accomplish wonders that no one else could have. And that's something that I think, you know, resonates even today.
And of course, to make a film work in dramatic terms, you have to veer from the truth. It's not a documentary, it's a completely different way of telling a story. Did that element of it give you sleepless nights as to how to make that work?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it was a tremendous responsibility of knowing this was a true story. And, you know, paying tribute to Alan Turing was something that we needed to do with great care and great consideration. And, you know, it's such an amazing story that every time, you know, when I describe it to people, when I tell people what really happened, they'd be like, oh, well, you must have made that up. There's no way that's true. And it's like the most fantastic parts of the story are absolutely true. It's you would never believe it if someone, you know, didn't have proof that it really happened.
Would you feel, after your experience of making this film and researching this story, do you feel it's important to keep Bletchley Park alive?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think as a tribute to the people who were there and as a piece of history that people should be aware of and should visit and should see and should take part of. I think, you know, the world around us has been made possible thanks to Bletchley Park, and that's something that we should never forget.
Awards seem to be in the air right now, as Bletchley Park itself has been nominated for some very prestigious museum awards. Kelsey Griffin spoke to Bletchley Park Trust's CEO, Ian Standen, to find out more.
So, Ian, we're here today to talk about the great news that Bletchley Park has just been shortlisted for the Museum and Heritage Awards in the category for Restoration and Conservation. First of all, can you tell me a bit more about the project for which it was shortlisted?
Well, yes, this is a shortlisting for Project Neptune, which is our big Heritage Lottery funded project, which we launched last June. As many listeners will remember, this is an important project that had three stages to it, really, or three elements to it. One was creation of a new visitor centre in former Block C. Secondly, restoring two of the wartime co-breaking huts, taking them back to as they were during the Second World War. And finally, taking the centre of the park back again to as it was in 1914-41, so that visitors can enjoy the site and understand what it was like to work in Bletchley during the Second World War. Really important project for us because it's now made the site so much more accessible, both in terms of just being able to get around it and also being people who get access the Bletchley Park story. And it's really transformed our visitor offering, which is sort of borne out by ever increasing visitor numbers and satisfaction in what they're seeing.
These are very prestigious awards. This must be quite an accolade for Bletchley Park.
Yeah, this is great. This is a great endorsement of all the work that was done, of course, during this project, but even, you know, many years before that. It's been a long old path over the last sort of 23 years or so of the Trust history to take it from where it was with this derelict site to now this thriving heritage attraction where people can come and see and indeed walk in the footsteps of the co-breakers of World War II.
So the other nominations include the Tate and Historic Royal Palaces. It must feel great to be ranked alongside such iconic national treasures as those.
Absolutely, and a great privilege and honour for Bletchley Park to be there. And I think, as the chief executive of ALVA said the other day, you know, the bar was set very high, so to get even onto the shortlist is great for the site, and they said further endorsement and recognition of the hard work that's gone on here over many years, and particularly in the last 3 years during this project.
What are your chances of winning?
We hope they're very high. We've got a great product here, and we hope the judges are going to see that we have got a great product, and it'd be fantastic for us to get another accolade for the hard work that's been done here.
You're in the running for other awards as well this year.
Yeah, we are in running for the Art Fund Museum of the Year prize. We've submitted an entry for that, and we'll see how that goes. And indeed, tonight we're off to the Milton Keynes Business Achievement Awards, and there's a number of irons in the fire that may or may not come to fruition over the coming weeks and months, and we'll keep our fingers crossed.
Best of luck that you filled the trophy cupboard up this year.
Thank you very much.
When Joan Lewis turned 18, she joined the Women's Royal Naval Service and became a Wren. After basic training, she was singled out and asked about how she would feel about working in a room without any windows at night. The senior Wren asking these questions then said she could tell Joan no more about it. Her lifelong friend Joyce Rogers joined her, and the pair worked together operating bomb machines at the outstation in Eastcote. Joan looked back 70 years during a visit to Bletchley Park last year, soon after her friend had passed away.
You were at Eastcote.
Yes.
How did you join up and come to be there?
Well, I joined the Wrens with a friend, and incidentally, my very best friend who worked with me at Bletchley and so on died a month ago. Joyce Hall, and Joyce Rogers, as she was then. And we joined the Wrens together. We went up to Tullyhewan, it was when they'd changed the place because of the doodlebugs in London. And we were there for a fortnight, and I went in to see the senior Wrens, and this was to decide what I was going to do in the Wrens, you see. And she said, how would you feel about working in London? And I said, right. She said, well, how would you feel about working in a room probably where there weren't any windows? And all this sort of thing, and would you be prepared to work at night? And all this. And then I got quite interested then. I thought, oh, yes.
Very mysterious.
That's very mysterious. She said, I can't tell you anymore because I don't know anymore, you see. So I said, okay, you know, yes, put me on. And I went back and told Joyce, and she said, oh, in that case, if you're going to do it. And one of the reasons why I think I was suggested was because I had left school, waited until I was able to join the Wrens, old enough, and I'd got a job in a bank, and my bank manager had put on my, they'd asked for, the Wrens had asked for a reference, and he'd put, is completely safe to deal with confidential information, and I think that's what they did, you see.
You could be trusted and to keep quiet.
Yes, which I did, you know. In fact, when I left and went up to a Wren's place at the end of the war, and the captain came round and he said, and what were you doing, you see? And I said, I can't tell you, sir. He said, oh, don't be ridiculous. What were you doing? I'm sorry, I can't tell you. Because, I mean, it was just after the end of the war, you see. I mean, it was 30 years, wasn't it, before we arrived.
But you didn't even know it would be released, did you, at that time, just after the war?
No.
As far as you were concerned, you'd signed that, and that was for life.
Yes. Eventually he accepted it, but he was very annoyed.
You mustn't have come across that before.
No, I don't suppose.
I suppose a strident manner could perhaps bully some people into thinking that they could. But I've never come across anyone in all the people I've met who worked at Bletchley and the outstations and the entire operation. I've never come across anyone who said, oh, I was, you know, cowed into telling someone. It was always bigger than the person standing in front of them saying, you must tell me, be that their father, an employer, or whoever. So you stood your ground.
Yes, I did.
Well done. You were obviously worthy of the faith put in you by the bank manager,
well,
weren't you?
Well, I felt so, yes.
And
I think it was that. Because, you know, why did he pick on me? And, because what we'd done more or less was, you know, the usual, learning how to salute and learning how to march and, you know, have all the usual things when you first join up. So Joyce went in and said, well, if my friend Joan's going, I'm on, you know. They took us both.
Excellent.
And we've been friends ever since.
She must have had the right stuff as well, though.
Yes, she had, undoubtedly. We worked together on the bomb.
Partners in crime.
Partners in crime, yes.
It must have been quite unusual for you to be able to stay tight with your friend like that in something where you're selected.
Yes.
And a lot of people I've spoken to don't know why they were selected. Yeah. You've got a clue with your job at the
bank. Well, I assumed that that's what it was. And as I say, she was in a local government and then perhaps got a reasonable reference as well. And we both got school certificates and been at grammar school. And I suppose they were looking for that sort of person, I don't know.
It must have been a great comfort to go so far from home into something so unfamiliar, something so serious, with a dear friend at your side. That must have been great.
Oh, yes, it was, it was.
Because most people were just thrust in among strangers.
Yes, well, exactly. Although there were quite a few girls from locally. We lived in Sutton Coldfield and maybe... It was a good place, I don't know.
So you went to Tullyhewin for basic training, then we went straight to Eastcote from there?
Yeah, well, we were trained at Eastcote.
I see.
Yes, so we trained at Eastcote, and that's where we stayed, actually.
Did you ever come to Bletchley?
No, I don't think, I can't remember, it's such a long time ago, whether we ever, I have a feeling we did once. But we did have, sometimes people came and told us what we'd been doing, you know, what the results of some of the things. On the odd occasion, a couple of times, we had someone coming from the War Office or something. But
that must have helped you.
It did. Oh, yes. Actually, we quite enjoyed it. We made ourselves enjoy it, I think. You know, we were great friends and... So we had no other problems to make us miserable, and we were okay.
Were you on watch together? Did you get the same shifts?
Yes. Oh,
that's
yes.
That's amazing.
Well, we worked together, you see. We did, the two of us. I think all the bomb people had to, because, I mean, you got to do this front and the back, and then we swapped around and checked each other's.
Because it was very exact, wasn't it, of course? You had to be very precise. So.
Oh, yes, totally. Yeah.
Concentration must have been quite intense.
Yes, it was.
Do you find that you were sort of competing with your own records and competing with other pairs as to how quickly and well you could do it?
I think we just sort of got on with it. We knew how important it was and we just got on with it. I don't think we ever had any very much competition. Possibly because we knew each other, you see. I think perhaps, as you say, others came in and they'd got to get to know somebody. I mean, we could just sort of get straight into it because we didn't have that problem of finding out about each other. We just knew. We'd been at school since we were about 12, you see.
So how long did you serve as a Wren?
Well, not terribly long because I wasn't old enough to go in as soon as I... So it was... I was trying to think when I joined. Just 18, I think, yes. And I was born in 26, so you can work that out.
Around 70 years ago now, then, roughly.
Yes.
So what happened after the war for you?
Well, I went and did a secretarial course, actually. And then got a secretarial job. And then I started having the children, so two of them here today. I've got one that isn't here because she lives at home and she's got MS, but two of them are here.
At least one of them lives in Norway now, you spread out.
One of them, the big one, that's my son, and he's married to a Norwegian girl, and they're just lovely. And the other one, I can't see, she's the youngest.
What's it like for you to bring them here and show them the machine and what you did?
Well, in a way, I suppose, I feel a bit proud, you know, that I did my bit for the country. They made me put this on, and I said, no, I don't want to put this on. Don't be ridiculous. And they forced me to. They fastened it on to me. They said, you've got to.
That makes you a VIP in these parts.
Well, I suppose it does, yes.
You know, never mind that it was one of the outstations, never mind that there were so many people doing any one job, it was all important.
It was really, wasn't it? That's what I said, that, you know, there were just hundreds of thousands of us, because I said it wasn't just us working at Bletchley, it was people, the people that took the messages, the people that, there were so many, there were thousands of people, and all over the world, and on board ship and all the rest of it. I've said that many times. Oh, mine was just a little bit of a, you know, a bit of a silly thing, really, compared with what other people did. But I feel, you know, I did my best. I did what I could for the country, and it's quite nice thought, you know.
Is it nice to see it recognised now?
Oh, yes, yes.
And did Joyce enjoy that too?
Yes, she did, yes. She did come and see it, but although she wasn't a traveller at all, she didn't like. But she did come once and see it all. I don't know, actually, whether there was a bomb machine when she came, but she saw Bletchley, which has changed since I came last. It's different.
Yes, we've got a big to-do list.
Yeah, yeah.
And you must come again, because very soon we're opening up all sorts of new things. So, yeah, two of the huts that very nearly fell down, because they were just built like big garden sheds, really. They're about to be opened up, and they're very atmospheric inside. And you should today take a look inside Hut 11, because that was the original bomb hut, and that's dressed now to look as it would have done, roughly. Yeah. We're having a new visitor centre, and another one of these big solid buildings that had run into dereliction. Yeah. That's all been turned round. And so next time you come, after June, there'll be even more to see.
Oh, yes, I'll come and have another look at it. Because it's changed even, so, as I say, since our last game, which is quite a few years. I haven't been... I came to one or two of the reunions, but now you see, without Joyce, it's not the same.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk, find us on iTunes and Twitter, where we are at BPark Podcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audio Boom, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. And if you like the Bletchley Park podcast, don't be shy, write a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.